Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and get a $25 service credit when you sign up.
Fiercely independent. Dan Carlin. Common sense.
Less than a week ago, we had another one of our semi-regular mass public shootings here in the United States. You'd like to say that they're shocking and unexpected, but they're not. What would be unexpected is to go a couple of years now without one, so depressingly familiar. This time it happened east of Los Angeles in the city of San Bernardino, and the current tally of casualties looks to be about 14 dead, 20 or 21 injured. But there are some very unusual aspects to this particular mass shooting that make it stand out from most of the other ones we've had. Not all of the other ones, by the way, but most of them. And in some ways, the mass shooting of 6 days ago is the worst nightmare of anti-terror planners come true. Now, first of all, it's worth pointing out that it is terrorism, what happened 6 days ago. And there are people out there that will say that every mass shooting is terrorism. But remember, the strict definition of terrorism requires that the attack is designed to have a political purpose, to change government policy, is what some definitions say. But no matter how strict you want to, you know, be about that definition, the attack of 6 or so days ago meets that standard. I was going to talk about it a couple of days ago, and I'm glad now that I didn't, because a lot of the initial information that came out of the story turns out to not be true or be different than initially speculated about, which is typically the case. I mean, we react in a news sense whenever these things happen, and it always seems to be a pretty good lesson to wait a little while, and there are probably people in the audience who will quite correctly suggest that it's still too soon to talk about. But if I'd done a show 2 or 3 days ago on this, I think I would have gotten quite a few things wrong, maybe more wrong than I'm going to get today. How about that for covering my rear end? What we seem to know now is that the attack was carried out by a couple, a husband and wife, which already makes it unusual. The husband, an American-born citizen of Middle Eastern descent who was Muslim. His partner in crime, his wife. Born in Pakistan, it looks like. Isn't that right, Ben? Pakistan, here on a visa. One of the news stories I initially read said he was living the American dream, had a 6-month-old daughter, a good job, all these kind of things. And then one day, apparently, drops the 6-month-old daughter off at grandma's house. He and the wife go home, dress in, you know, tactical gear, go back to his workplace party, and begin to shoot up the get-together. Now, initially, it looked like this was completely out of the blue and nobody, you know, had any idea that something like this was coming. In subsequent investigations, now they're saying, oh, well, you could definitely see the signs. And now they were doing pre-planning and they were going to gun ranges and doing all these kinds of things. So right there, that would change how we would view the story. But the reason that it is such a nightmare come true for anti-terror planners is that it involves one of the two scenarios that provides the most dangerous possible outcome for the country. We all know what the first scenario is. The first scenario is the idea of terrorist groups getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction. Now, even though today, in legal cases, if you show up with a hand grenade somewhere, they'll charge you with possession of WMD, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about nuclear materials, biological materials, chemical materials, the sorts of things likely to cause tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of deaths. Absolute nightmare for anti-terror planners, right? Keeps them up at night. But the other thing that keeps them up at night is the idea of homegrown, self-radicalized terrorists. People that are not foreigners, people that have not necessarily gone and pledged allegiance openly to another cause or another country, which, by the way, there's a lot of people that will argue that if you pledge allegiance to someone like ISIS, you shouldn't get American constitutional rights anymore anyway. You know, and I can see the logic in that. But the problem happens when these people haven't done that, when they've just taken, you know, 2 more steps down the road to radicalism from something that might be called extreme conservatism, you know, on religious, or extreme orthodoxy. And it's part of what makes this situation so dangerous. First of all, any time that you have a situation where you begin to believe that your countrymen are potentially the enemy within, or fifth columnists, as they used to be called, you now open up the potential to tearing yourselves apart. If I can use the analogy of a dog with fleas, and Lord knows I've had a lot of dogs, the fleas do damage, there's no question about it. But oftentimes, when your dog's in real trouble due to a flea infestation, the real damage to the dog comes from the dog scratching itself and biting itself to try to get rid of the fleas, and they'll tear themselves to pieces. The terrorists are the fleas. We're the dog. And the minute we start thinking that fellow Americans are the enemy is the time we start doing the terrorists' work for them. I want to draw some comparisons to a time period that people who are my age and older remember. I always have to remind myself that I'm getting to be an old guy, too, because I'll say something like, back in the 1980s, I was doing this, and someone will tweet to me, I was two back then. And so I have to kind of recall what people, are old enough to remember. But we are seeing, it's not the repeat of a movie, because there are key differences, but it is a very similar film, if you will, to what's called the Second Red Scare, which was the big communist scare that was especially prominent in the 1950s, but really continued into the 1960s, and we lived with the fumes of it even into the 1970s, where people feared the communists amongst us. If you're in the Second World War and you're fighting the Nazis in Germany, that tends to bring the country together. Now, are there some German Americans whose store windows get smashed and whatnot? You better believe it, but it's not the same. By and large, it unifies the country. Now, we all can remember, though, certain incidents which are considered to be black marks on our nation's history that are similar to some of the proposals you're already hearing people talk about. We locked up Japanese Americans on the West Coast because we were worried that in a war with Japan, they were going to be saboteurs and spies. There was a famous incident, and many of you probably know about it, where a submarine, not that far from where this shooting happened, by the way, the other day, surfaced off the coast and lobbed some shells at the U.S. coast and freaked people out, right? It's fear that does this. The fear is what gets the dog to start biting themselves to pieces. And we had this fear in the 1950s where we worried about Americans being essentially brainwashed. We've used the term intellectual contagion in the history show before, and I love that phrase because it makes ideas out to be like germs. And if the idea is something we consider to be positive, like freedom, freedom is the kind of intellectual contagion that's like good bacteria, if you ask me. But of course, there are others. The fear back in the 50s was that, you'd send your good Boy Scout-like kid off to college and some, clandestine communist professor would indoctrinate them with leftist ideas and they'd come home a communist, right? Then they'd start to undermine the country, the sort of things we did in the United States in the 1950s to deal with communist infiltration are the very definition of un-American. Ripping the Constitution apart and violating people's constitutional rights and making things illegal that are clearly within someone's, constitutional protections. For example, there's always been a distinction between thought and action, thought and deed. If you do something, we can bring the hammer down on you, and very few people argue about it. But if you merely think something, that's when things become very controversial. I don't know how many of you know this, but it was illegal to be a communist after 1954? President Eisenhower signed a bill that was passed, I believe, by both houses of Congress unanimously, making it illegal to be a member of the Communist Party. Now, that's a political, thought. To be a member of a political belief system is a First Amendment right, even if the political belief system is something that's dangerous, potentially. Supposedly, it's when you act on that that the hammer can come down. So here in the United States, let's say you have somebody who is a conservative, orthodox, religious person. Muslim, Christian, Jewish, fill in the blank. Now, if you sit down with them at dinner, they might scare the heck out of you with how, vociferous they can be and how hardline. But they're protected, right? They have a First Amendment right to freedom of religion to be that way. It's only when they do something that's actionable that you could turn around and say, listen, buddy, everybody's got a right to freedom of religion, but you can't go out and hurt somebody. The problem with reading some of the things that people have written, for example, at the news stories online, they have the comment section underneath, you can begin to see people talking about turning Muslim religious beliefs into something that's really akin to the way we treated communist thought in the 1950s. And what's so short-sighted about it, and why if you're an anti-terror planner, this looks like the country getting ready to tear itself apart, is because, and we've talked about it all the time, haven't we? All of the rights and freedoms and civil liberties and constitutional protections that have been, you know, put under pressure by the war on terror. I mean, you add the war on communism, the war on drugs, and the war on terror together, those three things have eviscerated constitutional protection. I mean, the fourth is gone. We talk about that all the time. But there are certain things that are, you know, relatively still intact that this shooting the other day endangers. And I'm not sure people see it. For example, the freedom of religion, which is a First Amendment right. At what point does someone's religious beliefs become actionable? Let me read you some of the comments, and these are random. I didn't go find the worst comments I could find. I went to three or four websites, including the New York Times, and just copied and pasted a few, you know, of the comments by readers. Now, there were a couple of really deep, thoughtful, wise ones, and of course, you know, that's what we say when they agree with us, right? Isn't that typical? But most of them, one way or another, sounded like the ones I'm going to read to you. Can you hear the danger in these statements? Now, understand something. This is all predictable, right? This is what terrorists want. This is the exact reaction that the people who strike us want us to have. And by the way, as an aside, after the Paris attacks 3 weeks ago, there were a bunch of really good articles pointing out that the reaction that European governments had to those attacks was exactly what the people, you know, who may have carried out the attacks were hoping for. It was a public relations nightmare for the people who run the Islamic State to have so many Muslims fleeing from them, because the way they sell themselves is that this is a place where they can be protected and be Muslim and come here, right? They're kind of trying to do for Muslims, Sunni Muslims, what Israel does, right? You'll be safe here. This is the homeland for the Jews. This is the only place where you can really be trusted to be safe, and you can live as a Jew, and you will take care of you, and we'll protect each other and all that kind of stuff. Well, ISIS is trying a similar sort of line. It looks really bad for their propaganda when the very people that they're saying, you know, come home to Islam are fleeing out of terror. So they may have, these articles said, launched these attacks as a way to convince the European governments, don't take these people, send them home, right? Stop these people from doing things that actually work against the public relations of the Islamic State. And of course, you know, we reacted predictably. It's very hard not to. President Obama gave a speech the other night, I read in a news story, one of only three addresses, primetime addresses to the nation. Can that really be true? If so, I think he's given less than any president since Eisenhower. But in his 10-minute speech, one of the things he said, and there were a lot of things I didn't like, in 10 minutes there were a bunch of things I didn't like, but the one thing he said that I did was 3 to 5 times he said, this is exactly what he calls them, ISIL, but to keep things from getting confusing, we'll still call them ISIS. He said, to do this, the standard knee-jerk reaction that we all kind of satisfyingly want to happen is to do just what they want us to do, right? Closing the borders to Europe after the Paris attack is exactly why the attack was launched, according to many news stories. So it's very hard to sit back and take the wise approach when the wise approach requires you to do the exact opposite of what your heart and gut tells you to do. Do you see any presidential candidates running for office saying anything other than, vote for me, I'll kill more terrorists than my opponent? Because that's what Americans want to hear, right? That's, maybe this is the downside of the kind of political system we have, is that it caters to that lowest common denominator and doesn't reward someone who's trying to be wise and to protect your constitutional rights. Let me read you a few of these comments that I cut and pasted from, you know, the comments section underneath these news stories concerned with this attack in San Bernardino. And I think you'll begin to see the dangers that I'm talking about when you talk about the anti-terror planners worrying about us turning against our own people out of fear. The first one, quote, you do not let any new Muslims in the country. You make all non-American citizen Muslims leave the country. You notify and watch every known Muslim in America and take action against them at the first sign of trouble. We're at war with them, so make us as safe as possible. Monitor the internet and shut down any sites we need to. Get back to monitoring all communications for terrorist activity and put all suspected American citizen terrorists in long-term holding for public safety. We are at war with Muslims. Not all of them, but the majority. So let's start acting like it and take the actions to make America safe. End quote. I have another one. Quote, this was supposedly a sane, rational Muslim without an ounce of hatred in his bones. He's referring to the person who carried out the San Bernardino attacks. He continues, quote, "Then he embraces extremism and goes on a killing rampage. Unfortunately, this is happening with more and more frequency. To Muslims without an ounce of hatred in their bones. The United States government should deport all Muslims living in America, with the exception of the ones that have converted to Christianity, Hinduism, or Buddhism. They could make their final destination resemble a new subdivision, calling it Gitmo Reserve." End quote. Here's another one. Quote, "President Roosevelt," meaning Franklin Roosevelt in the Second World War, "had a good idea once when he dealt with the Japanese in America after Pearl Harbor. Round up all the Muslims and put them in those supposed FEMA camps all over the country until the FBI can ascertain whether they're terrorists or not. After all, we are at war, and it is evident that you can't tell the supposed good ones from the bad. After a few years, if they're vetted, give them $100 and let them out." End quote. Here's another one. Quote, "Here's a start. Stop letting those Muslims in the country and get rid of the ones here. They're breeding kids over there to kill us. At age 5, they start MMA fighting and knife-stabbing drills, shooting and training on machine guns and bomb-making at age 10. If Obama lets them in, citizens better arm up. Our family is. There's not enough police to protect all. See how many cops are on duty in your neighborhood at any time? Protect your family." End quote. There's another response to the question of the Saudis, and more people are waking up to the fact that, you know, our government has a sort of a two-faced policy about this terrorism thing. They keep talking about taking the gloves off, you know, getting tough and you know, you're either with us or against us. Isn't that what George W. Bush said, you know, more than a dozen years ago? And yet there are people that get a pass. The Pakistanis have always been very iffy on this whole question, right? Sort of Jekyll and Hyde. And Saudi Arabia, I read a Tom Friedman column the other day, and, you know, I don't like Tom Friedman. You don't like Tom Friedman. He's not got a lot of big fans amongst the people I know. But his whole column was about how the Saudis aren't as bad as you think when you actually go over there. But here's what this one person writes about it. Quote, "Finally, a major Western power opens its mouth against Saudi Arabia, which is the source of this despicable worldwide murdering spree by brainwashed Muslims. The world should mobilize and seize their oil fields to repay all the damage they've caused. If I were president, I would do just that and keep oil flowing for free to the USA until they pay for the Twin Towers, support all the families of the 9/11 victims for life, and finally promise to stop funding and stop radicalizing by spreading Wahhabism. I would also threaten them with nuclear annihilation, starting with Mecca and Medina the next time our people are attacked. That's how you do it. This is the language these Islamists understand and will respect. I would have no problem turning Mecca into dust." End quote. Now, as I said, the president gave a speech the other night trying to warn us off this kind of predictable response, a human response. As I said, terrorism is designed to provoke standard human reactions, right? And it's very hard to react differently. Now, before we go on, I do want to criticize the president's speech, though. I think he blew it in major respects. And listen, he didn't do anything that a Republican president also wouldn't have done. It's, again, a downside of our system. But in a speech designed to sort of pull Americans together and tell us that we're all in this together and not to turn against your countrymen, he took several swipes at his political opposition. And you think to yourself, okay, even if you want to do that, why would you do that in a 10-minute speech where the main overriding point of the speech is to pull us together? One of the things he slammed Republicans for was for not signing on to the authorization of military force, the AUMF, it's called. The AUMF, for those who don't know, is an absolutely symbolic thing. Now, the president and supporters of this will say, and listen, the Republicans would say if the shoe were on the other foot, that for the Republicans to sign and say that Congress is behind the president's efforts in places like Syria, you know, bolsters our troops and shows our allies and our enemies that we are united. All they have to do is watch one of our political debates or our or read some of our, you know, online news magazines to know that that's not true anyway. The AUMF idea is a corruption of what the true constitutional role of Congress is supposed to be, which is we're not supposed to be in wars if Congress doesn't declare them. As we've talked about many times on this program, that is a use it or lose it power. Congress has not used that power since the Second World War. They have seemingly lost it. So now we have this totally symbolic AUMF instead. It's a joke. It's unconstitutional. And it allows us to once again duck the entire question of war declaration. So I think it was dumb to bring that up and slam your opponents for that. The other thing he did was go after guns. Now, I understand why he did that. I don't know what the true numbers are, but if we said half of the United States is anti-gun and half the United States is pro-gun, that will serve for our purpose. Why would you take this as an opportunity to slam half the country when the speech is about pulling the country together? Why would you use this as an opportunity to alienate and then force a political knee-jerk reaction from the other side, a predictable, understandable one? And listen, it's 3 weeks after the Paris attack. You don't have to be a genius to realize that France has gun control laws that the people who would like strict gun control laws in the United States couldn't even dream of enacting in a lifetime. And how were the majority of the 100-plus people killed in Paris? How were they killed? With the exact same kind of weapons that people would like to see banned in this country. Now, if you banned guns in the United States, would there be less gun deaths? Absolutely, I think so. But not terrorism ones, probably. For the major reason that, you know, if we haven't learned this about drugs yet, I mean, there's a black market, folks. You can get what you want with money. There's a reason the government is worried about people out there buying nuclear fissionable materials with cash, because if you've got cash, people will sell. So this idea that somehow, you know, banning guns is going to have a significant impact on terrorism is stupid. You shouldn't have brought it up. There's another place and another time if you want to have that argument. This time it just divides the nation again, when the entire point of the speech is to do the opposite. And when the biggest fear we have, other than terrorists getting their hands on, like, nuclear weapons, is us tearing ourselves apart in a political climate when we're already doing a pretty darn good job of that without terrorism. You know, folks, here's the thing I keep thinking of. For many, many years we've discussed, I mean, this is going back, almost 20 years now, where I've been talking about something I call 9-12, 15 years, right? 14 years. 9-12 is the next big terror attack, right? And I always say, you know, what's going to happen when that happens? If you imagine, say, the same sort of changes that we've seen since 9-11 happening again, but from where we are now, what will the country look like, right? We talk about tearing up the Constitution. But, you know, it occurs to me after the San Bernardino attack that maybe it doesn't have to be some giant high-profile attack that kills 3,000 Americans like the last 9-11 did. How many of those San Bernardino attacks that we had 6 or so days ago would you have to have happen? Over what period of time for the cumulative effect on our national psyche to be similar? What if you had another one of those in a week, and then another one a month later, and then another one a month and a half after that? How many of those do you think we could stand before you ended up with the equivalent of a 9-11 attack, right? And what I would say to conservatives out there is that that attack in San Bernardino the other day directly attacks some of the rights that conservatives most revere. I mean, the gun rights are a perfect example. Look at how that attack put some of the conservative Republicans on the defensive in interesting ways. Now, I always take the libertarian wing of the Republicans and separate them, because they tend to be much more concerned and consistent about seeing the dangers to constitutional rights for these things. But there's a whole bunch of them that keep talking about getting rid of due process and anything else we need so that we're not namby-pamby in wartime. Well, what do you do when the terrorists start using our own Second Amendment rights against us? When you're talking about taking the gloves off and doing what you need to do to keep Americans safe, and Americans start getting shot up by our own weapons, you know, what does that do to your philosophy? Now, if the early indications are any measure, some of these people are just doubling down. We don't need fewer guns, we need more guns. You need shooters, you know, who are good people at these mass shootings to take down the bad people. Well, listen, nobody would stand up and cheer louder than I would if that happened. And I'm somebody who does believe that firearms do protect people in a lot of occasions, and certainly have their uses. And I've always said that. But I have yet to see one of these mass shooting incidents end because some citizen shooter took the gunman down. And I would be very concerned if I were a pro-gun person on what would happen if a shootout did occur and you found out some of the victims died because the citizen good guy shooter shot them by mistake during a gun battle. Nonetheless, that's one of the areas where you begin to see conservatives it's going to be scary because the Second Amendment is very important to a lot of conservatives. And now you see the terrorist exploiting that as a way to hurt Americans. And another thing that they should be concerned about is freedom of religion. Those comments that I read where those people are so ready to treat Muslims the way we treated Japanese Americans in the Second World War, you know, they act as though you can separate Muslims from other religious beliefs, right? That you could make an exception. If you were talking about doing any of this stuff to Christians or Jews or any of the more majority religions in this country, those people would be up in arms. But they're short-sighted if they don't believe that any exception you make to go after Muslims' freedom of religion and saying something like, you know, if you go and think anything too radical. Remember, the division between actions and thoughts used to be a pretty pronounced one. You can think anything you want. It's a free country, right? You can think Nazism and be a Nazi in your head. You just can't go out there and throw bricks through a Jewish store window, right? So the definition used to be action. But what these people are suggesting we treat Muslims like is to treat them based on their belief system. How short-sighted do you have to be to not see how that violates their freedom of religion, which opens the door to your freedom of religion being violated? The minute you start talking about, you know, dealing with people based on the way they think, especially the religious way, I mean, we had, since the last show we did, an abortion clinic shooting. Now, that's still being investigated and information is still coming out. But if it turns out that the early statements attributed to the guy who shot up the people at that abortion clinic turned out that he's a, what would you call it, a radical Christian? I'm not sure what the proper terminology would be. Can't you see how the same mentality that you're using to go after Muslims is not some special exception? That can easily be applied. And people will turn around and say, well, listen, if you can do this to Muslims based on the idea that, listen, you cross this line from Orthodox to ultra-Orthodox, and now you've become dangerous, even if you haven't thrown the brick through the Jewish store window yet, can't you see how that can be used against your religion? That's why it's always been taught to us, folks, that you have to protect the constitutional freedoms of people you dislike and disagree with, because it ends up saving that same wall that protects you. These people who want to lock Muslims up are not thinking straight. And I have to say, folks, you know, as somebody who had enjoyed the Donald Trump show and enjoyed watching Donald Trump put a monkey wrench in a political system that is so scripted and so predictable, and watching him discombobulate the entire Republican field, we've passed that point now. Now the guy is at a position where, okay, he's dangerous. And he's dangerous because the Constitution means nothing to this guy. He's a candidate that prides himself on results. And people that put impediments up in front of his ability to get results are weak. And things like the Constitution and citing that as not being serious. I mean, he's gone to a place now where you can clearly see somebody who is a danger to America's constitutional protections. And he's exploiting these sorts of situations. And the people who write those kinds of responses to news stories are the kind of people that would flock to a banner of a guy who's already said, as of this week, we shouldn't be letting any more Muslims in the country. I will say that one of the most interesting things about the time period we're living in right now is that you get a little chance to see, or feel is a better word, or hear maybe even a better word, an emotional echo, if you will, from an earlier time period. We did a hardcore history show a while back called Logical Insanity. And it was about the dropping of the atomic bomb. And the main point of that program, if I can dial it down to one thing, was the inability to really sit back in the comfort of our nice, warm, safe living rooms today and judge the actions of people who are living in a time period where they are fearful. I've long believed, and you know, I'm not a historian, right? I throw that disclaimer in there because it's true. But I've long believed that fear is a prime mover of events, and that even though we have tons of brave people, and every society does, when you get us in large enough groups, we sort of devolve toward the mean, and we become like a herd, and the herd is panicky and easily spooked and willing to do all kinds of things that as individuals we would not do. It's similar to the way mob violence can act, where individuals would never, you know, act out in ways that they do when you have the anonymity and the loss of individual responsibility that you get in a mob situation. But look at the locking up of Japanese Americans. I consider that to be one of the worst blights on Americanism in the 20th century. But now you get an idea of how the people back then might have felt, right? We're talking about doing the same things. Donald Trump said today, a veiled sort of, listen, I'm not going to judge those people. You know, it might have been the right thing to do at the time. I'm putting words into his mouth. But essentially, I mean, there's some truth to that in the sense that, okay, understand that the people were afraid and that people who are afraid are going to do things that later on in life don't look just. But that's what we're talking about doing now. Now, in a perfect world, we should learn from that. How many lives did it save to lock up Japanese Americans? I would suggest that more people died in that shooting in San Bernardino the other day than would have died if we had not locked up Japanese Americans. But when people are afraid, they do all sorts of dumb things. It's part of the reason why terrorists hope to terrorize you. They don't want you sitting back wisely and operating in a dispassionate sort of, and you know, I was watching the president in that speech, and he's saying things like, you know, we can't do this. This is what ISIL will want. Okay, that's great, but you're a politician in a political world where you're responding to the pressures of the voters, and the voters are writing things like the kind of stuff I just read to you from those news sites, right? They're not sitting back for the most part and telling you to be wise and to outflank the tactics of. I mean, that's not how we operate. There's a great section in Herodotus, and you know, we're using the ancient Greek historian from 2300 years ago in the current history podcast we're doing. And there's a section in Herodotus where he has three Persians debating the pros and cons of three different kinds of governments. And it's fascinating because it's always hard to see the downside of your own system of government because we're all raised to believe that ours is the best system. If you grew up in the Soviet Union in the 1940s, you know, you're raised the same way. Marxism is obviously the best. It will triumph. It's got all the, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when you read this ancient Greek writer argue the pros and cons of democracy, oligarchy, and monarchy, it's interesting because the democracy arguments are really on point. Let me read you a little about his arguments in the book and see if it doesn't sort of match the reaction not only that we have right now, the inability of us to sit back and be wise and instead devolve to the panicky herd where we act in ways that people who want to hurt us can depend on. So in the conversation, a Persian named Otanes argues for changing the Persian government to a democracy. Now, by the way, this almost certainly didn't happen, even though Herodotus says most people will believe it didn't happen, but I'm telling you it did. It probably didn't. So this Otanes argues to a bunch of conspirators that we should turn this thing into a democracy. Another Persian named Agabazos disagrees and points out the downsides of a democracy. And he says, this according to Herodotus, quote, "Next, Megabazos urged them to turn to oligarchy, saying, 'I'm in favor of what Otanes says in his attempt to put an end to tyranny. But when he tells us to transfer power to the majority, he has strayed far from good judgment. For nothing can be more unintelligent or insolent than the worthless, ineffectual mob. If men want to escape the arrogance of a tyrant, it is absolutely intolerable that they should then fall victim to the arrogance of the undisciplined common people. For whatever the tyrant may do, he at least knows what he's doing, whereas the people have no idea what they're doing. How could someone who has not been educated, who has never seen anything good or decent, be knowledgeable about anything? He pushes and shoves and stumbles into affairs without thought, like a raging torrent.'" End quote. You can read a lot of those kinds of criticisms from the ancient world. Now, those of us who are fans of the democratic slash Republican or a democratic Republican system of government, like I am, realize that there are downsides. We just feel like the upsides outweigh the downsides. But there are times when, you know, the problems with democracy are more dangerous than others. If you tell the dog not to scratch the fleas because he'll end up hurting himself more in the end, that's a hard thing for the dog to do, isn't it? That's essentially what you're asking people to do. Don't turn against your Muslim countrymen, even though some of them are going to go off the deep end, because if you do, you'll end up hurting yourself, right? Don't violate their freedom of religious rights because you'll end up hurting your own, right? It'll hurt you in the long run, but people don't think about the long run, and it's a known standard danger in a democracy. You go read the writings of a Roman emperor like Marcus Aurelius, who may be one of the wisest emperors who ever lived. And as many of you know, there's a book called The Emperor's Handbook, which is fascinating, and it was never meant to be published. It was really this emperor writing for himself, maybe like, you know, you would call them daily thoughts or daily affirmations or whatever. And when you read what he writes, you think to yourself, this is one of those rare people who are not only not corrupted by power, but they really almost are philosopher kings. And that's the kind of wisdom that you wish in situations like this, where so much is predicated upon us acting and reacting emotionally and in the heat of the moment and in predictable human fearful ways, where you wish you had somebody at the helm who could say, no, we're not going to do that. I know we want to, but we're not going to. We don't have that kind of system. We have a bunch of politicians running for president right now who are competing to suggest that vote for me, I'll kill more of the bad guys than the other people running against me. I mean, they're pandering to our fears. And if any of them stood up and told us we should back off and be wise, and they're not going to get rewarded for that. They're going to get penalized. So again, you see terrorism working very well to exploit the known, you know, weaknesses in our system. And it's going to damage our system. You get down to that line where, you know, Benjamin Franklin said those who would sacrifice essential liberty for temporary security deserve neither liberty nor security. Now, let me talk about the only thing that maybe Dan Carlin can bring to this debate. And that's factoring it down to components. Because the one thing I kept hearing both from Republicans and from the president when they talked about this over and over again is, we need to defeat ISIS. We need to do, you know, and I keep thinking to myself, well, before it was, we need to defeat Al-Qaeda. Now it's, we need to defeat ISIS. This is the bad guy group du jour. This isn't the problem. This is the current manifestation of the problem. And because of that, you know, we're playing whack-a-mole. We're playing whack-a-mole with groups, and we're playing whack-a-mole with weapons. Well, if we ban this weapon, we will decrease their ability to kill us, and eventually we will be left with gasoline and motor vehicles and arson and things that you just can't defend, right? So the whack-a-mole game is fruitless in the long run, and you'll end up doing all, you know, the president even said this whole threat is evolving now, and we've hardened these targets, and lo and behold, now they're going after targets we haven't hardened yet. Well, duh, it's called terrorism, right? They strike where we are weak. And you have to understand that the problem boils down to something that is not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, not religion. It's bad thoughts, folks. So here's what Dan Carlin's going to add, that what we're really here fighting are bad thoughts. And I had a conversation with someone. I don't expect you to believe me, and I don't expect you to believe the person I spoke to, but it was fascinating. And if true, it shows that the government at its heart understands that this is a battle against bad thoughts. And yet the danger in trying to fight that at the bad thoughts level, well, let's just say I haven't even gotten my mind around all the downsides. So let me bring it up to you a little bit. This is the way I want to start it. Imagine you're the president of the United States or the prime minister of Great Britain during the Second World War, and your generals and your scientists come to you for a meeting. And as you know, everybody's working on new weapons. I mean, the Manhattan Project's underway, and they're trying to develop a bomb that'll destroy a whole city, and all these things are going on. And now your generals and your scientists come to you, and they want money for research into something that, if they can get it to work, will provide something that you can drop into the German water supply. And once you do that, after enough of the German people have drunk, you know, from the water, the chemical that you have developed will denazify them. Do you approve that research? And if it actually bears fruit, do you deploy that weapon? I know you think I'm crazy right now, but I'll back it up a little bit. You know what propaganda is, right? Propaganda is an attempt to use sophisticated techniques to change people's opinion, change their minds. What could you do to voluntarily change their minds? But what could you do to take out the voluntary part? What is propaganda on steroids? Could you develop something in the laboratory that could change people's opinions of things. In other words, if you really factored down any given situation, say Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, to a question of bad thoughts, could you address that issue at the root? As I said, when the president and the Republicans are talking about defeating ISIS and putting troops on the ground, you just sit there and go, great, so then when the next terror group pops up, what do we do then? We're playing whack-a-mole. What if you address the question of, you know, the whole idea of terrorism at the root? And, you know, Dan Carlin has these ideas, and you've heard me say them forever, these long-term ideas for solving, you know, Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. I would compare that to saying we have a dam that's been leaking tons of water, and Dan Carlin's plan would plug the dam. But at the same time, we have lots of standing water to deal with, right? So what's Dan Carlin's plan for standing water? That's where, you know, perhaps current research comes in. Somebody fixed me up. Maybe you could call it a fix-up sort of get-together with a person not that long ago. And as I said, you don't have to believe me, although I'm not lying, and you don't have to believe what the other person told me, but I would not have had this fix-up if the person who fixed us up didn't know the credentials of the person he was sitting me down with. This person deals with clandestine activities and things that are going on all the time. He told me that the government is starting to address things at the mind control level. In other words, if bad thoughts are the problems, if plugging the dam doesn't solve the problem we have with water flooded everywhere and all the terrorists who are already infected, how do you deal with them? If at root cause, it's a question of bad thoughts. Well, what if you could change their mind? If you assumed people were brainwashed, like these killers who operated in San Bernardino the other day, could you unbrainwash them? And I've thought about what this guy told me ever since. Now, the logical thing for you to deduce probably is that this sounds like crazy talk, doesn't it? Dan Carlin just jumped to the head of the line in conspiracy talkers out there with his suggestion about government mind control, you know, efforts as a solution to the war on terror, and every other problem you might attribute to bad thoughts as a root cause. But here's the way I divide something that sounds like you should wear a tinfoil hat from something that seems quite a bit more rational. Have we done it before? If you have a person who lives on your street corner and somebody says, oh, don't let your kid go, you know, near that guy's house, you know, he's a child molester, but that person's never been accused of anything, never been charged with anything, never been arrested for anything, well, that might just be one person's opinion, right? If, on the other hand, the person served time in jail for child molestation, well, then it's a different question when somebody says, don't let your kid play out in front of that house. They may be cured, but once upon a time, you know, they had that problem. It's not theoretical. What a lot of people in this country don't know is that the idea of the government trying to deal with what we might, you know, for lack of a better word, call bad thoughts, has a history. It's not theoretical. Can it really be a tinfoil hat thing when our government has spent millions, perhaps billions of dollars in research on this already? And for about 20 years was working on the problem. Many of you know, and so I'm not talking to you, about a bunch of government programs, the most famous of which is probably MKUltra. MKUltra is one from the 1950s. It's a CIA/Army program, and there were more than 100 sub-programs. There was also, you know, Project Bluebird. There's a whole bunch of these things in the 1950s. Now, the way supposedly these things started was that when we were dealing with the early years of the Cold War after the Second World War, we had the Korean War going on, for example, it appeared as though we thought some of our captured troops, and we also thought politicians in Eastern European countries that were under Soviet domination, might be brainwashed by the other side, which led to all sorts of experiments, first of all, designed to try to figure out countermeasures. Right? If the Soviets had figured out some way to brainwash people, how could we resist that? And then also efforts to try to figure out how we could respond in kind. Now, just for what it's worth, both the Soviets and the West had captured Nazi scientists and researchers who were working on similar things. And so both sides had this idea that we were taking modern 20th century science and applying it to things like truth serums and mind control, and all, I mean, to this day, we don't really know everything that was going on. The CIA destroyed most of the documents in 1973. In 1977, in certain hearings, this came out. LSD, for example, was one of the main components that the CIA for a while was working on to try to figure out if that was something that could be used to alter people's minds. Go look it up. Go do a little research on it. And what you'll see is that if our government was working on mind control as a way to try to deal with terrorism at the source, right? If you have a bad idea, how do you unbrainwash the people that have been infected by the bad idea? If it's an intellectual contagion, how do you either insulate people from being infected in the first place or give them the equivalent of cerebral antibiotics to, you know, purge them of the bad thoughts? What this person had said to me, whether you believe him or not, made me think about the logic of it, right? Because if the government has boiled down the terrorism issue to the, you know, root cause of bad thoughts, how do you deal with that? And I'm of two minds about this. One part of me thinks that's smart. You know, because if we're really playing whack-a-mole with Al-Qaeda, now we're playing whack-a-mole with ISIS, now we're playing whack-a-mole with, you know, the next group that pops up, eventually you want to start to say, well, stop this. These are all about bad thoughts. Let's start inventing something to get back to our Bill Gates slash, you know, innovation acceleration from the last episode. Let's invent something that allows us to turn people's bad thoughts from being bad. But think of how dangerous that is. It becomes another one of those examples. Again, reminds you of logical insanity, the hardcore history episode we did, and a thousand other trade-offs that human beings make all the time between the needs of the now and the long-term implications of something that could be incredibly scary when applied to a bunch of other things. In other words, if you decide that, you know, violent terrorism is a bad thought, I think most Americans right now would heartily agree with you. But if you then gave the magic bullet to governments to stop the bad thoughts, what happens when they start changing what a bad thought is? And, you know, as we said when drone attacks used to be a monopoly of the United States government, what happens when other people get their hands on this? So if you say, I trust the United States government to use any sort of bad thought indoctrination weapon correctly, what happens when the Chinese get their hands on it? Or, God forbid, what happens if the terrorists do? It also becomes an argument, by the way, which people used during the Cold War era for why you might have to develop those capabilities. You may say, well, we don't really want these capabilities. In a perfect world, we would not want to influence people's thoughts and do any brainwashing at all. But if the other side's going to do that, we have to make sure we can at least fight that. Now, for those of you who think that this is just crazy, I would like to point out that there's already very scary work being done by our government in similar areas for completely noble purposes. Many of you are familiar with an agency called DARPA. DARPA means the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The motto, if you go to DARPA's website, they say they are, quote, creating breakthrough technologies for national security, end quote. DARPA has operations that extend to all sorts of outsourcing agencies. They work with universities, small businesses, all kinds of entities are doing DARPA research, and they don't always know what the end results of the research will be. But these are giant efforts involving the intellectual capabilities of the whole country in various ways, like a web of knowledge, if you will. One of the things that the DARPA research is doing involves trying to help soldiers who are coming back from battlefronts with traumatic memories that are impacting their ability to live normal lives, or even live their lives. I mean, communities all over the country have veterans who are freaking out and having problems and having terrible, tragic outcomes to lives and damage that occurred to them trying to help us all, right? So it makes sense that the government would be working on ways to help those people. Research has gone quite far into the question of whether or not you could remove memories of people with tragic, damaging memories and inject new false memories in their place. Now, as I said, this is for a noble purpose, right? You're trying to cure people who have been, you know, traumatized, and they have these parts of their brain that are like cancers that are destroying their lives. If you could cut that cancer out and replace it with something that's a happier, better memory, gosh, you would give those people their lives back. That's a great cause, isn't it? But obviously, you know, it becomes a dual-use technology, doesn't it? And it's right up the realm of the bad thoughts question. So when you think something sounds tinfoil hat-ish, realize that research along those same lines is already ongoing, and breakthroughs are happening every day. If you decide that at its very root, we are not in a war on terror per se, we are in a conflict against bad thoughts, what sort of weaponry do you have to fight that? Dan Carlin has always talked about, you know, a war for the hearts and minds of the Islamic world. That's an old line now, hearts and minds war, right? But must you fight that with simply a better idea? And if the better idea takes a long time to win that hearts and minds war, a generation, two generations, could you make an argument that you could save countless lives and tons of suffering, and not just on our side, but I mean, we need to recall that the people who are bearing the brunt of the majority of the damage in this Islamic civil war, as I and many other people refer to it, are Muslim folks. You could easily sit there in the laboratory and make the case that a mind control drug that de-radicalized people would save tons of Muslim lives. You would say that it's addressing root causes, that this is finally getting smart, right? That's logical insanity in a way, as we talked about in the atomic bomb episode. At the same time, can you imagine your government having the capability to use mind control to create better outcomes? I mean, think about a whole range of issues. You could almost, if you wanted to craft it that way, turn it into a paradise-inducing sort of situation, right? Instead of having to take guns away from people, you could just put something in the water supply that made people less violent. And I've said before, you know, when you go to Europe, the fact that Europe is less violent is not necessarily because they have less guns. They are less violent. And if you all of a sudden took all the guns away from Americans, you're still going to have a lot more killings than Europe. Why is that? Because we're more violent. What if you could address that at the root cause level? You could make a paradise on Earth, right? You would think. But who in their right minds would trust the government with that kind of power? Bad thoughts is something that is a question that's an eye of the beholder situation. In the same way we had said to you before, if you're not careful about protecting the rights of Muslims and the freedom of religion, you will find that that will start affecting Christians. Well, at what point, if you start saying we're going to start using DARPA-invented anti-brainwashing methods to keep Muslims from being infected with radical jihadist beliefs, at what point does the government decide, you know, how many abortion clinic shootings by beyond the fringe Christians do you have to have before somebody says something like, you know, we're having just as much trouble with Christians who go beyond the pale as we are with Muslims. Why not give them the same treatment we're giving the Muslims? I guess what I'm saying is a tool like that is just so darn useful. It would be weird to think we would just use it against, you know, the single cause of Islamic terrorism. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but in a way, that's the most intelligent example of dealing with a problem at the root that I've heard anybody talk about. When that person told me that that's where things were going, I thought to myself, one, well, that's smart. And two, that's scary. Now, just so you know, officially, the reason that the U.S. government stopped its mind control experiments, although there are conspiracy people out there that say that the government never stopped, that it was just a public relations thing to say that they did. But officially, the reason that the government stopped wasn't because it decided that they had violated some sort of public trust or that this was Orwellian or that it was wrong and immoral. Officially, the program stopped in the late 60s, early 70s because it was found to be ineffectual. That the idea behind mind control and brainwashing and anti-brainwashing, defense against brainwashing, that it wasn't a bad idea, it just wasn't feasible. It wasn't working, the experiments were not paying off. If that's the case, at what point do you turn around and say, well, hey, you know, that was 40 years ago. We're a hell of a long way down the road to new technologies and things that never would have been thought possible 40 years ago. We should be looking into that kind of thing again. When the government said after 9/11 that we're going to start doing things that would have been inconceivable before, that we're not, you know, it's time to start playing in the darkness realm. It's time to start doing different. I mean, conceivably, isn't this a direction you could see things going? Which president would you trust with the mind control capability? Donald Trump? Hillary Clinton? And if you say, oh, I wouldn't trust any of them with that, we need to make sure something like that is never used and never developed because it's just too darn dangerous. Well, that sounds great on one level, but what happens when the Chinese get their hands on it? Or the Russians get their hands on it? Or ISIS gets their hands on it? How long can you keep something like that out of the hands of the other people? Remember, a lot of the people that backed up this idea that this was the right thing to do in the 1950s did so on the grounds that the other side was already working on it. And that you had to be able to defend yourself against what they might do. But if you go up and you look up MKUltra and you look at the things that happened, you get a really clear idea for how quickly something like that spirals out of control. And once again, we have another one of those conflicts between the needs of the now versus the long-term implications, right? You might have to do things to win this particular war, but then the world will then have to deal with what you invented to win that war and the ramifications of that, you know, for ever afterwards. I think there are probably few people who understand this dilemma or have thought about it as much as physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer did. Oppenheimer, of course, is someone who's sometimes called the father of the atomic bomb, a person who worked very hard to find the weaponry to end the worst war mankind had ever been involved in, and in part because of his efforts created the conditions for an even worse sort of Armageddon afterwards, the first time in human history that people had an opportunity and a means to destroy and wipe out the species entirely. In many ways, Oppenheimer fits into this story quite a bit because he was a leftist thinker, perhaps communist, in ways that today we would turn around and say, well, you know, you have a right to think that if that's the way you believe. But the country at the time certainly didn't agree with that. Oppenheimer was bugged, his mail was opened, he was followed, he was spied upon, he was hauled in front of congressional committees to try to prove that he wasn't a communist, and eventually his career was essentially derailed and destroyed because people were afraid, in part because of the weaponry that Oppenheimer helped develop. And there's a quote attributed to Oppenheimer that fits in perfectly with what we're talking about here and almost seems to run against the grain of how we as human beings operate. He's supposed to have said, quote, "It is perfectly obvious that the whole world is going to hell. The only possible chance that it might not is that we do not attempt to prevent it from doing so." End quote. A British-born American philosopher, a guy who died in 1973 named Alan Watts, used that quote and tried to explain what it meant, and he said, quote, "As Robert Oppenheimer said a short while before he died, it is perfectly obvious that the whole world is going to hell. The only possible chance that it might not is that we do not attempt to prevent it from doing so." And then Watts says, "You see, many of the troubles going on in the world right now are being supervised by people with very good intentions, whose attempts are to keep things in order, to clean things up, to forbid this and to prevent that. The more we try to put everything to rights, the more we make fantastic messes. Maybe that's the way it's got to be. Maybe I should not say anything at all about the folly of trying to put things to right, but simply, on the principle of Blake, let the fool persist in his folly so that he will become wise." End quote. That doesn't seem to be too bad of a approach if we're dealing with individuals. But as we said earlier, you know, you can find brave individuals in every society in the world, but once we get together in large groups, we turn into a herd of scared, frightened creatures. And in the same way that you could also pick out wise people and people who learn and people who get it from any society in the world, when we get back into the herd, we're not wise. We're reactive and we're panicked and we look for short-term solutions to problems, often in ways that create long-term dilemmas that are worse than the short-term problems we hope to solve. If we're depending on the human species to get wiser as a way for us to avoid disaster, I'd say the odds on that are long. And this is exacerbated by the form of government we have, because you can get lucky occasionally with a dictator or an emperor or a king who for some reason gets it. Now and then you get a Marcus Aurelius, right? somebody who can say, I don't care what the people think, I'm telling you they're wrong and I'm going to take the wise approach and I don't have to listen to anyone. But in a system where the will of the people is supposed to be translated, you know, via the representatives, how many representatives are going to get up and answer the question of what will you do to keep me safe, with an answer saying that the only possible chance of doing that without destroying everything is to not try to keep you safe? Call me a fool, but I'm thinking to myself that person's not getting a whole lot of votes in any democratic republic that you can look at today. We've been telling you about Ting on this program for some time. Mobile service made easy. And someone tweeted to me just the other day on Twitter saying, thanks for telling me about Ting. I'm saving a fortune on my cell phone service. Ting says $23 is the average individual bill per phone. If that's more than you're paying right now, you might want to go to Ting's website and use their savings calculator and see if you too can save money on Ting. Businesses are saving thousands of dollars a year. The service is very customizable, very able to morph into what you need. And they also, you know, avoid many of the things that just drive people crazy about dealing with the main cell phone companies. Ting scored very highly, by the way, on a recent consumer report comparing, you know, their service to some of the big boys. I mean, for example, you know, for me, one of the big deals is that they don't lock you into a contract. That's something I hate. As I've said before, it seems almost anti-consumer right off the bat, right? If you want to have a cell phone service, you have to sign this contract. And if you want to leave because you're not happy with the service, you have to pay us money. Ting will actually pay you money to help you pay to get out of your contract. If the early termination fee is required for you to switch services, they'll give you 25% of the early termination fee up to $75. That's a good way to start a new relationship with a cell phone company, don't you think? Ting also has more than one network to choose from. So if one of their networks is better than another one in terms of better service where you happen to live, you can use that one. There are some phones that can actually switch between both, as I understand it. There are no overage charges or penalties, no add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. You only pay for the service that you use. They have a powerful online control panel that people like quite a bit to help manage the amount you use. And not just you, but if you're a parent, to help keep track of what your kids are using, or if you're an employer, what your employees are using. It's an innovative new way to do cell phone service, and it's something that's catching on amongst lots of people. You would do yourself a favor by going to the website and checking out what Ting has to offer. And if you end up liking the deal and signing up, you can get a $25 service credit by going to dancarlin.ting.com.
You want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.